Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
It's good to be back.
Today, we are taking a journey that's a bit different from our usual historical overviews. I think this is one of the most intellectually rigorous topics we've ever tried to tackle.
I would absolutely agree. We're moving beyond just the narrative of what happened and wading into the, into the really critical waters of testable claims.
Exactly. Testable claims. That's the key. Our focus today is on the founding narrative of early Mormonism, but specifically, we're looking at the most explicit and, you know, measurable prophecies and revelations given by Joseph Smith.
That's right, because when you're dealing with the claims of someone presented as a prophet, you're handed this unique, very high-stakes intellectual challenge.
It's not just about faith at that point.
Not at all. A prophecy, unlike a purely faith-based claim, offers a direct, evidence-based litmus test for the authority of the person delivering the message.
So our mission today is pretty straightforward, but I think it's also profound. We are applying historical outcomes against prophetic claims to see how they stack up.
We're looking for those nuggets of knowledge, you know, the patterns that emerge when you do that comparison.
And what's so great about this kind of test is that it's not something we just invented. This isn't a modern skeptical framework we're imposing on the past.
No, it's the ancient standard, a truly rigorous one that you find enshrined right in Scripture itself, specifically in Deuteronomy 18.
The standard set out there is, it's just completely unambiguous. It's the instruction manual given to ancient Israel for how to identify a false prophet.
And the core quote is really what's driving our whole analysis today. It says, "If the thing follow not nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken, but the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously. Thou shalt not be afraid of him."
That is a harsh metric.
It's incredibly clear, though.
It is. If the prediction fails, the conclusion is absolute. It means the speaker isn't acting on God's behalf. And that follow-up instruction is maybe the most crucial part for anyone listening.
Thou shalt not be afraid of him.
Right. You are explicitly told not to grant authority to that person based on fear or assumption or anything else if their specific testable claims are demonstrably false.
And we really need to hold on to that framework today, because we're not interested in, you know, generalized inspiration or vague spiritual feelings.
No.
We are drilling down on the explicit declarations, the date-specific statements, the geographical mandates, the promises that are tied to concrete material outcomes.
Okay, so let's lay out how we've structured this deep dive for you. We've organized the sources into really three key arenas of failure.
Right.
First, we're going to look at the clear time-bound failures, the ones that had a hard deadline. Then second, we'll get into the large-scale institutional failures, especially everything surrounding the establishment of Zion in Missouri.
And that's where we'll see these mechanisms of control like blame reversal really come into play.
Exactly. And then finally, we'll look at some of the smaller, but I think equally telling anecdotes, the stories that show a pattern of creative storytelling and some pretty serious financial flops.
All right, let's jump into this first category. These are the prophecies that were given a deadline, and, well, they spectacularly missed it.
Yeah, historically, this is always the biggest risk for any prophet or movement. The moment you commit to a specific date, you create a verifiable public point of failure.
You can't fudge a date. It either happens or it doesn't.
Precisely. And we're going to start with maybe the largest time-bound declaration of them all, the 1891 Second Coming prediction.
The context for this is so important. Where and when was this said?
This was recorded in what's known as Minute Book 1 back in February of 1835. This is peak Kirtland, Ohio. The church is buzzing with activity, with expectation.
A sense of urgency, a palpable sense of urgency. Joseph Smith is speaking to a group of elders, getting them ready for missionary service, talking about the sacrifices they'd all made trying to redeem Zion. They truly believed they were living in the absolute final years of Earth's history.
So what did he say specifically about the timeline? Because from what I've read, the language is surprisingly quantitative for a divine revelation.
It is. He's talking about the role of those who had sacrificed for Zion, and he states they should be ordained to the ministry and go forth to prune the vineyard for the last time, or the coming of the Lord, which was nigh, even 56 years, should wind up the scene.
56 years.
56 years.
So 56 years from February 1835 puts you squarely in February 1891. That is not vague. That is not metaphorical. It's a mathematical deadline for the end of the world as they knew it and the second coming of Christ.
It's a hard stop. Yeah. It gives you a date on the calendar.
And of course, we know what happened in 1891.
Nothing.
The event just did not occur. The scene did not wind up. Jesus Christ did not return.
It was a total non-event.
Now, I know there's a common historical reinterpretation of this, an apologetic defense. The standard argument is that this prophecy was somehow conditional.
Right. That it depended on Joseph Smith himself being alive in 1891. Or maybe that the saints had to achieve some higher level of righteousness for it to happen.
So does the actual source material, the original Minute Book 1, does it support that conditional reading at all?
Absolutely not. And that's the critical point.
Yeah.
When you go back and examine the original record, the language is declarative. It's a statement of fact, not a conditional offer.
There are no ifs or buts.
None. There is no caveat that says, if I, Joseph Smith, live to 1891, then this will happen. This statement is about a divine timeline. That's it. This apologetic interpretation is purely post facto.
It's a logical maneuver you have to make after the failure.
It's a necessary one if you want to protect the prophet's authority.
This pattern is so common, though, isn't it? If you look outside Mormonism, you see it with the Adventists after the Great Disappointment of 1844, or the early Jehovah's Witnesses and their predictions about 1914.
It's a classic psychological mechanism.
When a hard-date millennialist prophecy fails, you often see the followers digging in deeper, not fleeing the movement.
That's the key psychological insight here. It's famously described by Leon Festinger's theory of cognitive dissonance.
Right.
When a belief you hold very deeply, especially when you sacrifice for, given your time, your money, your reputation, is contradicted by undeniable evidence, like 1891 just passing quietly.
The easiest path isn't to admit you were wrong.
No, because that would mean admitting your sacrifice was for nothing. That's too painful for most people to accept.
So instead of abandoning the core belief, you double down on it.
Exactly. You reinterpret the failure. You find a new explanation. You might claim the event happened spiritually, not physically, or that the calculation was just slightly off. Or, and this is a common one, you claim that you, the follower, were the cause of the delay because of your own unworthiness.
So the blame gets shifted.
Always. This allows the core belief structure, and crucially, the authority of the prophet, to remain intact. In the case of 1891, the church leadership had to quickly manage expectations without ever admitting a fundamental error in prophetic timing.
That need for, you know, control over the timeline seems to get even more intense when Joseph Smith is under pressure. And few things caused him more pressure than the massive political failures in Missouri.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's pivot to this other colossal prophecy, the one about the imminent overthrow of the U.S. government.
This one comes in 1843, and to understand it, you have to feel the sheer fury that was fueling it.
This wasn't a calm, meditative revelation.
Not at all. The saints had been violently driven from Missouri. They had faced Governor Lilburn Boggs's infamous extermination order. They had suffered incredible violence. Their property was stolen. People were killed.
And they appealed for help.
They appealed directly to the U.S. government for redress for protection under the Constitution, or at the very least, compensation for what they lost.
Mm.
And they were repeatedly refused all the way up to the president.
So he felt completely betrayed by the entire American democratic structure.
Utterly. And that's why this prophecy is so telling. It feels less like a divine warning and more like an act of retaliation channeled through divine authority.
So what were the specific words?
He declared that he prophesied in the name of the Lord God of Israel that in a few years the government will be utterly overthrown and wasted, and there will not be so much as a pot shirt left for their wickedness.
A pot shirt? That's vivid language. It means total annihilation, just broken pieces.
And the rhetoric only escalated from there.
There's another version, right?
There is. A second version published later in the Millennial Star was even more extreme. It stated, "They shall be broken up as a government, and God shall damn them, and there shall be nothing left of them, not even a grease spot."
Not even a grease spot. I mean, that is a statement of total, definitive, absolute dissolution of the American state. There is no ambiguity there.
None whatsoever.
Well, here we are nearly 180 years later, and the United States government, it's still here. Arguably, it's the single most powerful and enduring political structure in modern history.
The failure here isn't about, you know, a spiritual event that got delayed. It's a concrete political prediction that just flat out did not happen.
Which brings us to the main historical defense of this prophecy, the claim that the Civil War fulfilled the prediction.
Yes, that's the go-to argument, that the war between 1861 and 1865 was the fulfillment.
So let's break that down. Why doesn't the Civil War actually stand up as a fulfillment? I mean, it was an incredibly bloody, near-fatal conflict for the country.
It fails the test of the original language. A civil war is a brutal internal conflict over the continuation and the structure of the Union. It was not an utter overthrow and wasting.
The government wasn't destroyed.
Exactly. The Constitution remained the foundational law. The institutions, Congress, the presidency, the Supreme Court, they were all preserved. Even as the nation fought with itself, the structure survived. It wasn't wiped out and replaced with nothing, which is what not even a grease spot implies.
It's like if you prophesy that a skyscraper will fall down in 5 years and then it suffers a really severe fire that closes it for repairs, you can't come back and say the fire fulfilled the prophecy of total collapse.
That's a perfect analogy. The original standard of utterly overthrown has to hold. And there's another piece of context here we can't ignore.
What's that?
Joseph Smith's own political ambitions at the time. This declaration of America's imminent demise happened at the exact same time he was consolidating his own theocratic government, the Council of 50.
Which was designed to be a world government.
An explicitly organized governmental structure designed to replace the failed governments of the world, starting with the U.S. He wasn't just predicting a political argument. He was predicting the creation of a vacuum into which his new kingdom would step. The context proves he meant the entire system had to go.
Before we move on from these time-bound failures, there's one more. It's a smaller example, but I think it gets overlooked, and it's deeply illustrative of how fragile these commands could be.
You're talking about the prophecy given to David W. Patton.
Yes, recorded in DNC 114.
That's a really powerful micro-failure.
Mm-hmm.
So DNC 114, which was received in 1838, it commanded David W. Patton, who was one of the original 12 apostles, to settle all his affairs and get ready to go on a mission.
And it gave a specific deadline.
It did. The following spring, which meant the spring of 1839.
So a clear command, a clear deadline. What was the outcome for Patton?
He was killed. Just a few months after receiving that revelation, he was shot and killed during the Battle of Crooked River in October of 1838.
Months before the spring deadline even arrived.
Right. He was never able to fulfill the command he was given by God. He was dead.
This just highlights the incredible vulnerability of this whole prophetic structure to, well, to basic human mortality. How can God issue a divine, absolute command, one that's going to be canonized as holy scripture for all time, that is immediately and irrevocably negated by a man's unforeseen death?
It raises a fundamental question about omniscience, doesn't it? If the God speaking through Joseph Smith was truly omniscient, he would have known that Patton was going to be dead before the mission could even begin.
It makes the command seem pointless.
It makes it seem like the command was operating on a purely human temporal level. It was subject to the same unpredictable forces that govern anyone else's plans. The failure here wasn't about a lack of faith or disobedience. It was a failure of factual reality.
So if the time-bound failures show us a pattern of miscalculated deadlines and political frustration, the institutional failures surrounding Missouri, they show us a pattern of economic chaos and some really sophisticated control mechanisms. We're pivoting now to the grand, sweeping vision of Zion. This was supposed to be the ultimate expression of early Mormonism, but its explicit commands resulted in such widespread failure that they required massive theological retrofitting later on.
And we have to start with the economic mandate that was supposed to power the whole thing, the Everlasting Covenant of the United Order, which you can find in Doctrine and Covenants 104.
This was the communal living system, right?
Exactly. Members consecrated all their property to the church. And it was described in the Revelation, explicitly by Jesus, as being established for the benefit of my church. And this is the crucial part, is an everlasting order that would last until I come.
An everlasting order, not a temporary experiment.
No. This was meant to be the permanent economic engine of God's new kingdom on earth.
And the rhetoric that came with this mandate was, it was severe. This was not a friendly suggestion.
It was an ultimatum. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The revelation promised a very sore and grievous curse for any man who dared to break this covenant.
And what were the reasons someone might break it?
Through covetousness or feigned words. And the punishment was clear. They shall be cursed in his life and shall be trodden down.
The stakes could not have been higher. You're talking about temporal and eternal damnation if you fail to live this one specific economic system.
Complete damnation.
So what happened to this canonized, explicit, everlasting covenant?
It collapsed. Utterly.
It wasn't just modified.
No, it was a total failure. The United Order was attempted briefly in Kirtland and in Missouri. And it just resulted in economic confusion, internal squabbling over who got what property, and just managerial chaos.
So it was abandoned.
It was abandoned very quickly because it was fundamentally unworkable, at least in its initial implementation. And it has never been reinstated or successfully practiced as it was originally mandated.
Which brings up the defense mechanism. The one used to explain why the Everlasting Covenant is, in fact, entirely temporary.
Ah, yes. The famous ubiquitous phrase.
Members weren't ready.
That's the one. And that phrase serves a brilliant dual purpose. First, it completely absolves the prophet and the revelation itself. The logic is, God's law was perfect. It was the people who were flawed.
And the second purpose?
It keeps the doctrine on the shelf. It allows it to remain canonized as this ideal that the church might return to someday. This justifies why it's still in the scriptures, despite its catastrophic failure in practice.
It completely sidesteps the core issue, which is that a covenant declared by God to be everlasting failed within just a few months.
And that failure of the economic order fed directly into the failure of the geographical center of Zion, the New Jerusalem Temple in Independence, Missouri.
This prophecy from DNC 84 offered another one of those ironclad timelines.
DNC 84, which came in 1832, is so specific. It names Independence, Missouri, as the center place, the location of the New Jerusalem. And then it gives this key time commitment.
What was it?
The revelation stated that a temple shall be reared in this generation, for verily this generation shall not all pass away until a house shall be built unto the Lord.
We really need to underline that phrase, this generation.
It's the whole point.
That explicitly promised the early members, the actual saints who were alive and breathing in the 1830s, that they would live to see that temple completed in that spot.
And it just didn't happen.
Not even close.
The saints were violently expelled from Jackson County, Missouri in the mid-1830s. The temple was never built. And to add insult to injury, today, that physical temple lot, the sacred spot designated by God,
it's owned by another church.
It's owned by another branch of the Restoration Movement, the Community of Christ.
The outcome was so devastating that it forced a critical theological transformation within Mormonism. It basically required them to redefine the entire concept of Zion.
Absolutely. The failure to secure the physical location forced a theological pivot. It had to. If the physical gathering to Missouri failed, the definition of Zion had to change to maintain the spiritual narrative.
So Zion becomes an idea, not a place.
That's when you see the rise of the idea that Zion is no longer just Independence, Missouri, but that Zion dwells within us. Or that the gathering is to the stakes of Zion, wherever they might be located around the world.
It's a classic example of an ecclesiastical doctrine being retrofitted after a clear prophecy of a physical fulfillment has failed.
It's a direct response to failure.
Which brings us to the most dramatic attempt to fulfill that geographical mandate. The attempt to physically retake Zion, the ill-fated military expedition known as Zion's Camp in 1834.
This whole chapter is just a study in conflicting commands and ultimate failure. It even starts with an immediate failure of protection.
What do you mean?
Well, earlier in DNC 97, there was a promise that Zion cannot fall, neither be moved out of her place, for God is there.
And yet
the saints were moved. They were forced out by mobs. So that initial promise of divine protection had already failed before the camp even started.
So after that first prophetic failure, a new set of revelations, DNC 101 and 103, were issued, and these commanded the retaking of Zion by power.
Yes, by power. The command was for the prophet to gather 500 men and redeem the land through military force.
And the revelation didn't mince words.
It pulled no punches. It says, "Let no man be afraid to lay down his life for my sake." This was framed as an absolute, divinely mandated military campaign.
500 men was the target. How many did Joseph Smith actually manage to muster for this 800-mile march from Kirtland, Ohio, all the way to Independence, Missouri?
He got a pretty paltry force, somewhere between 150 and 200 men.
So less than half.
Much less. Mm-hmm. And these weren't seasoned soldiers. They were farmers, blacksmiths, artisans. They were poorly equipped, and they were embarking on this grueling, agonizing march.
Just the hardship of traveling that distance must have been immense. The hunger, the disease, the infighting that was reported.
It was brutal. Imagine the level of dedication and faith required to even undertake an 800-mile march like that, expecting a miraculous victory at the end.
But when they finally arrived in Missouri, they were faced with established, well-armed, local militias that just massively outnumbered them.
And the whole mission just collapsed. It was a humiliating outcome. Joseph Smith was forced to disband the camp. He realized the military objective was completely, laughably unattainable.
So the command to redeem Zion by power failed. The land wasn't retaken. The mission was a total disaster in terms of fulfilling its explicit objective.
A total military and prophetic failure.
But the truly critical moment, and I think this is the analytical peak of this entire failure, is what happened in the aftermath. The revelation that's recorded in Doctrine and Covenants 105.
Yes. DNC 105. This is the masterclass in prophetic blame reversal.
If you want to understand the dynamics of high-demand religious leadership, this is essential reading, isn't it?
Absolutely. The entire purpose of this revelation is to explain why God's divine absolute command failed, but to do so in a way that never, ever implicates the command giver.
So God himself provides the excuse for his own failed promise, but the blame is placed entirely on the rank-and-file followers.
That's exactly what happens.
What specific condemnation is leveled against the saints in DNC 105?
The failure, according to this new revelation, occurred because of the transgression of my people, meaning the church body as a whole. God states they have not learned to be obedient, that they are full of all manner of evil, and that they did not adequately impart of their substance.
Just let that sink in for a moment. These are the people who sacrificed everything. They gave up their property in Kirtland, their livelihoods, and then they endured a brutal 800-mile march. All because they trusted their prophet.
And they're the ones who are condemned.
They are accused of being evil and disobedient for the failure of a prophecy they literally risked their lives to try and fulfill.
And here is the most manipulative part of the entire chapter. The specific self-serving loophole that protects the entire leadership structure.
The exemption clause.
The condemnation comes with this sharp exemption. I speak not concerning those who are appointed to lead my people, for they are not all under this condemnation.
So, Joseph Smith and his inner circle, the very men who planned the failed campaign and issued the false command, are divinely absolved of all responsibility.
While the men who risked their lives and property are condemned as being disobedient and evil.
This is the definitive demonstration of that high-demand religious technique of blame reversal. It just flips the script completely.
It does. Instead of the prophet having to justify his failed revelation, the followers are immediately put on the defensive. They're forced to look inward, to introspect, and find fault with their own spiritual maturity.
And it ensures loyalty is reinforced through guilt, even in the face of the prophet's demonstrated inability to deliver on his own explicit divine promises.
It creates this profound psychological pressure. If you question the failure, you aren't just questioning the prophet, you're questioning God, and you're basically admitting to your own evil nature. It's an incredibly powerful tool of control.
All right, let's move to our third category of failure. These are maybe smaller in scale, but they're highly specific anecdotes and financial flops that I think reveal a great deal about Joseph Smith's creative process.
And his continued reliance on the 19th century folk magic traditions he grew up with, even when he's issuing what's supposed to be canonized revelation.
Let's start with one of the most fantastic tales from that Zion's Camp March, a story that perfectly blends prophecy with the prevailing cultural myths of the 1830s.
You must be talking about the story of Zelph the White Lamanite.
Exactly. Can you set the scene for us? Because it sounds like something pulled directly from a James Fenimore Cooper novel about the American frontier.
It really does. So during the Zion's Camp March through Illinois, the men stop near the Illinois River, and they discover an ancient burial mound.
Which were all over the place, a source of huge speculation at the time.
A huge source of speculation. So they decide to excavate it, and they find a skeleton. And it's described as having an arrow, specifically a lamanite-ish arrow, lodged between the ribs.
A lamanite-ish arrow.
Yes. And John Taylor, who recorded the account, noted that Joseph Smith immediately made a declaration by the Spirit of the Almighty.
So he receives instant revelation about this skeleton. What does he declare it to be?
He declares that it belonged to a man named Zelph. And Zelph was a white Lamanite, a man of God, whose curse was taken from him.
A white Lamanite.
A white Lamanite. Furthermore, Zelph was identified as this powerful warrior who ranged across an enormous territory from the Hill Cumorah or Eastern Sea to the Rocky Mountains.
Wow. Okay, that one short anecdote creates at least two massive, massive problems for modern apologetics that try to contextualize the Book of Mormon.
Oh, it's a minefield for them.
Let's start with the racial element. What's the problem there?
The phrase, curse was taken from him, is directly tied to Zelph being a white Lamanite. This directly reinforces the early literal doctrine, which is explicitly written in the Book of Mormon, that the curse placed upon the Lamanites was a literal change in skin color.
From white to dark.
Exactly. It completely undercuts any modern attempt to argue that the curse was just, you know, a spiritual alienation, or that the Book of Mormon's description of skin changing was just a metaphor. Smith's divine declaration right here confirms the literal racial reading.
And the second problem, which is maybe even more devastating, is the geography it establishes for the Book of Mormon narrative.
Yes. Zelph was a warrior who roamed from the hill Cumorah, the one in New York, all the way to the Rocky Mountains.
So this geographically cements Joseph Smith's entire belief system about where these events took place.
It makes the New York Hill Cumorah the actual site of the final great battles. It implies the Book of Mormon wars occurred across the entire breadth of North America, from New York to Illinois to the Rockies.
And that flatly contradicts the modern academic apologetic theories, doesn't it?
Completely. Theories like the Mesoamerican model or the Two Cumorah theory, they must place the Book of Mormon in a very limited geographical area far to the south. Because there is zero archaeological, linguistic, or DNA evidence to support a continental scope civilization of warring peoples in North America, as described in the book.
So Zelph isn't just a fun, quirky story. It's a geographical and racial anchor that destabilizes decades of careful academic defense of the Book of Mormon.
It is. And it reveals something so profound about the source of Joseph Smith's prophecies. Zelph is a textbook example of him integrating the popular and frankly racist 19th century mound builder myth.
The idea that some ancient, superior, often white civilization built the mounds and was then wiped out by the supposedly savage ancestors of modern Native Americans.
Exactly. He took that folk wisdom, that superstition and conjecture, and he stamped it with divine authority. He transformed it into sacred, canonized history. In a way, Zelph is the entire Book of Mormon narrative applied to a single skeleton.
Speaking of things turning into prophecy, let's move from creative history to desperate finance. Joseph Smith and the early church were constantly plagued by debt,
which led to the bizarre and secretive treasure digging mission to Salem, Massachusetts.
This was around 1836, right? A period of massive financial stress for the church.
Massive stress.
Yeah.
The Kirtland Safety Society was being established and was already facing imminent collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Smith was desperate for cash, and DNC 111 is the revelation that came as a result, commanding this mission.
And this revelation is just so explicit about the motivation and the expected outcome. It really does read more like a treasure map than a spiritual directive.
It does. God supposedly states, "I have much treasure in this city for you," referring to Salem. And the promise is extremely material. It's not vague at all.
What does it promise?
It promises that its wealth pertaining to gold and silver shall be yours. And furthermore, the explicit purpose was to relieve their debt. I will give you power to pay them your debts.
Gold and silver to pay their debts. The expectation was purely financial, material wealth to solve the church's debt crisis.
Absolutely.
So what happened when the men got to Salem?
The mission was a total flop.
No treasure.
No treasure was found. The debts were certainly not paid through this means. It was another failure.
And this failure gave rise to one of the most, I think, transparent logical gymnastics in modern apologetics.
Yes, the classic defense. The argument that the real treasure they found in Salem wasn't actually gold and silver, but conversions.
The real treasure was the friends we made along the way.
Essentially, yes. That the real wealth was spiritual. But this is just refuted by the explicit text of the revelation itself. God didn't promise spiritual sustenance or the salvation of souls.
He promised gold and silver.
A specific material outcome that simply failed to materialize.
You know, it raises a powerful question about theological consistency. If God is truly omnipotent, why is he sending his prophet on these elaborate, secretive, and ultimately failed treasure hunts to solve simple cash flow problems?
Instead of just providing resources through instantaneous means, like we see in countless biblical narratives like the fishes and the loaves, I think it links directly back to Joseph Smith's foundational worldview. He started as a treasure seeker, using folk magical methods, seer stones, treasure maps, secret missions. That was the culture of his youth. The DNC 111 revelation simply cloaks a traditional treasure hunt in the language of divinity. It shows his personal history is inseparable from his divine claims.
And our final flop brings us back to the commodification of the sacred. The failed attempt to sell the Book of Mormon copyright in Canada.
This was a very early mission back in 1830, right after the Book of Mormon had been printed. The nascent church was, again, desperate for funds.
So Joseph Smith receives another revelation.
Yes, directing a small group, including Oliver Cowdery and Hiram Page, to travel to Canada, specifically the four provinces, to sell the copyright.
They were essentially going to franchise God's divine word.
That's a good way to put it. The inherent absurdity of the command is just stunning when you think about it. God, the divine author of this sacred text, is directing his prophet to secure the intellectual property rights so they can be sold for a profit to the Gentiles in Canada.
It transforms the most sacred claim of the entire religion into a mere commercial asset to be bartered.
And just like the Salem mission, the outcome was simple.
The mission failed.
Completely. They were unable to sell the copyright. They came back empty-handed.
But this revelation is a classic example of what I'd call prophetic hedging. It had a crucial, built-in loophole that preemptively justified any failure.
That is the essential insight here. Success was made conditional. It depended on the Canadian people not having hardened their hearts against the enticings of my spirit.
So it was never God's fault or the prophet's fault.
Never. The failure of the mission wasn't a failure of the revelation or the command. It was the fault of the Canadians for being spiritually obstinate. It's a mechanism that ensures the blame is immediately externalized onto anyone who rejects the message.
And that psychological resilience we talked about earlier, it's perfectly illustrated by the response of one of the participants, Hiram Page.
It is. Page, who had endured this arduous, pointless, failed journey, reportedly doubled down on his belief afterward.
How did he rationalize it?
He explained that he now understood that the revelation was fulfilled because he learned a lesson from it. The lesson being, apparently, that he should not question the prophet, even when faced with demonstrable, expensive failure.
Wow.
It just shows how followers, once they've sacrificed so much, will internally restructure reality itself to maintain harmony with the authoritative claim. The belief has to be protected at all costs.
So we have completed a very deep, very evidence-based survey today, really comparing these testable claims against the historical outcomes. Before we conclude, let's just synthesize the clear patterns of prophetic failure we've identified across Joseph Smith's early revelations.
I think we've seen some very clear categories emerge. First, you have the time-bound failures.
Right, the 1891 Second Coming.
The promise that the U.S. government would be utterly overthrown in just a few years. And the command for David W. Patton to serve a mission the following spring, which was, you know, nullified by his death.
All of them showed the serious disconnect between the divine command and just temporal reality.
Then you have the second category, the geographical and institutional failures.
This is the big one. The collapse of the so-called everlasting united order.
The prophecy that Zion cannot fall, which was immediately followed by the saints being expelled.
The failure to build the temple in Missouri in this generation.
And of course, the disastrous military expedition of Zion's camp. All of these required massive theological and geographical restructuring later on just to cope with the failure.
And third, we have the financial and anecdotal flops.
The failed Salem treasure hunt for gold and silver, the failed attempt to sell the Canadian copyright for God's word. And the Zelph anecdote, which, while it's a fun story to tell, created these irreparable conflicts with the physical and racial claims of the Book of Mormon narrative.
But I think the most consistent meta pattern we've really uncovered here is the strategy that was used to rationalize these failures.
Yes. When a prediction did not come to pass, the response was remarkably uniform.
You saw a changing of the definition of key terms like generation or treasure.
Or redefining failure as just a future fulfillment that hasn't happened yet.
You saw the use of external blame like the Canadians hardened their heart.
Or most manipulatively, the claim that the members weren't ready, which shifted the failure from the leader onto the very victims of the failed command.
This whole catalog of defense mechanisms, the logical inconsistency, the special pleading, the post facto restructuring, it really shows that the established narrative of divine authority had to be protected at all costs.
Even when the evidence provided by the prophecies themselves directly contradicted that authority, the objective evidence was always, always molded to fit the beliefs, never the other way around.
So if we take all of this testable evidence, the explicit failures of deadlines, of geography, of material outcomes, we have to return to that initial standard we set out, the one from Deuteronomy 18.
If the thing fall not, nor come to pass, the instruction is clear. The prophet has spoken presumptuously.
And this historical record, which consists of repeated, verifiable, and significant failures of explicit prophecy, it objectively renders the claims of Joseph Smith being the reliable sole spokesperson for God as fundamentally questionable.
And it does so based on the very criteria set forth in the Abrahamic tradition that he claimed to be a part of.
The knowledge we've gained today is, I think, a crucial tool for critical thinking. If you look at the entire record and you acknowledge that, you know, a Broman watch is right twice a day.
Meaning even a false prophet will make some vague statement that might later seem to come true.
Exactly. But if we rely on emotion or community loyalty or social pressure to confirm authority, we ignore the most objective tests that are available to us.
Which leads us to the final provocative thought we want to leave with you today.
It's this. If the prophetic claims, which are the most critical and objective test of a religious founder, are demonstrably unreliable based on historical outcomes, how many testable failures should a historical figure be allowed before we conclude that the claims themselves are fundamentally flawed?
And that continued loyalty might be masking historical reality. It's a question that really compels you to move beyond emotion and engage directly with the evidence.
We really encourage you to examine the source material for yourselves, to seek out the original minute book entries, and to review the actual sections of the Doctrine and Covenants we discussed today, sections 84, 97, 104, 105, 111, and 114.
Read them for yourself and see what you think.
Thank you for joining this deep dive into historical claims versus historical outcomes.